Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Nate Berkopek, author of The Complete Guide to Rails Performance and the creator of the new Rails Performance Workshop. Nate, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jason.
Nate, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your book and your workshop?
Yeah. So if you're running a Rails app nowadays, you're probably running it on Puma. And I also maintain Puma, so you're probably running my code in production right now. As we're recording this, it's right before Thanksgiving. So by the time this comes out, Puma 5.1 will also be out. Please go and upgrade. we're doing all sorts of new stuff. Puma has really accelerated a lot in the last year or two. And I'm really happy with all the contributors we've gotten. So I maintain Puma. I've been doing this Rails performance stuff for the last 4 or 5 years, and I help people make their Rails apps faster, both as a consultant and as a teacher and an author. And I, as you said, I just put out this new video-based course, this video-based workshop that you can take anytime. It's speedshop.co. And I'm really happy with it. It's actually delivered via the command line, which I think is really cool and unique. It's got a command line client, so you can just like gem install RPW and check out the client right now.
And how does that work when it's delivered via the command line? Like, can you walk me through the details of that? Like, I just can't picture what that means.
Yeah, it's cool. It's, you know, like one of the things that I learned from the Complete Guide to Rails Performance was that I had these hands-on exercises in it, but no one was doing them. And I wanted to deliver this new workshop via the command line because I have a lot of hands-on exercises in it. There's almost 20 of them. And when you're in the command line, it's like you're already there. So like when you type, like, please give me the next lesson, it just opens up your text editor and the folder with the information and the files like ready to go. So I feel like it's going to make people more engaged with the actual hands-on content. So the actual like mechanics of it is like gem install RPW start, and then you enter in your license key that you buy from me, and then RPW lesson next, and then it gets you to the next piece of content. And there's all sorts of different types. So there's like videos, and then there's quizzes and hands-on labs, and then pull requests that you make to your app. So it just opens up the next piece, which might be a video, it might be text, it might be something else. So that's really sort of the mechanics of it.
Did you come up with that idea yourself, or did you see something else that was done that way, or what?
I saw something similar at the Flatiron School. So the Flatiron School is one of these coding boot camps, and they use this tool called Learn, which is a command line client. And the Flatiron School has a lot of web stuff, but they have a lot of They had this command line client that I thought was super cool. And the way that they teach people is like you download the lesson with the command line client, and then there's like tests usually in the lesson, and the lesson is to make the test pass, right? So I thought that was such a cool concept. A lot of the stuff that I do can't be boiled down into a test, but it was really inspirational. I was like, okay, this is pretty cool approach. I like the idea of developers learning on the command line. And just personally too, like I'm very interested, I guess, in free as in freedom software. So I'm not like ideologically pure Stallman advocate, because like I still use a MacBook Pro sitting here, and we're talking over Google Meet right now. So like I'm not like, oh, actually, you know, I'm sorry, we're gonna have to do this over Jitsi or whatever. Like I'm not a purist, but I am always interested in doing more free software when it's possible. And so in delivering this over the command line allows me to have a GPL licensed client and a GPL licensed server. So all the code that runs the course is completely open source and free as in freedom. And even the video files are encoded with libx 264. So like you don't even have to use unfree software to like interact with the course at all. So I knew it was possible, and I knew my audience would notice this and would like respect that. So it's like, why not do it?
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I hadn't heard of such a thing before. Obviously, like I've come across tutorials online where it's kind of like interactive. You type something and it gives you the next question. You can type something too. And there's definitely some merit to those, because it's like you obviously learning is like more powerful when you do it by doing rather than just reading something. But I think you're totally right that like when somebody's just sitting there reading an ebook and the ebook says, go do this thing now, it's like, ah, that's so much work.
Yeah. You're like, ah, you know, I'll just go to the next chapter, right? Like, so the fact that it literally opens your text editor for you with the thing ready to go, I think is going to help people to do this stuff, because performance work in general is a lot of it is pattern recognition, and a lot of it is something that you have to do some practice on. Like you gotta just like testing. I think testing requires a lot of repetition and experience. And like, okay, so how do I test this particular weird thing? And performance is similar to that. So like, just getting people to do the thing, even if it's in a very simplified like setup environment, I think is super useful and helps people to really understand the material.
Okay, let me ask you about that. So this hereby concludes our intro portion of the podcast, and now we're starting the actual me asking you questions about stuff. So you mentioned pattern recognition, and that is interesting. That like something clicked for me when you said that, because that rings true to me in my limited experience of performance optimizing stuff. It's like, oh, this is a case where it's hitting the database too many times. I know what to do for that. Or this is a case where blah, 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 I know what to do for that. Can you kind of talk about that a little bit more?
I think it's, well, the big one in my, one big area for this in my experience has always been the visualizations that come with performance tools. So the most popular one would be flame graphs. And also, that's also the same thing as a waterfall diagram, if you've ever heard of that. So these show up in performance a lot. It's basically looks like a bar chart kind of looking thing. And it's how we visualize the results of a profile. And the left side of the diagram is time zero. The right side is time whenever you finished. And all the little bars in between are, here's the stack, the literal, like the stack frame. Here's what the stack frame looked like at these different points in time. And people can look at that, and I can explain that to them, and they can understand that intellectually and say, okay, got it. And then it's like, okay, now what? Like, I understand, like, generally what this represents and what this means, but, like, what do I do with this? And there's a lot of pattern recognition in looking at a flame graph or a waterfall diagram and saying, oh, this is clearly an issue with this. Like when I do this in the workshop, I literally talk about like the physical, like the shapes of flame graphs and say like, these shapes generally lead to these outcomes, or these lead to these problems. And it's just something that I've picked up over the last, you know, 7 or 8 years, and just seeing these things over and over and know what they mean, that I can look at these tools visually and say, like, all right, well, this is this, this, and this, where someone that maybe understands the tool, but like doesn't know the patterns, would look at it and be like, I don't know what to get out of this. Right.
Okay. So yeah. Yeah. That's tough. I'm going to relate that to testing a little bit, 'cause obviously that's my thing. And you know, I've been talking about testing for about the last 3 years at this point, and I feel like I'm just now starting to learn how to teach this stuff to people. Mm-hmm. And something that I've learned is, like, okay, so half the battle is just knowing like what type of test to use. When you have a particular feature you need to build and you sit down and you're like, okay, I'm going to write some tests. What do I do? Do I use, let's say I'm using RSpec, do I use system specs, model specs, view specs? And there's like 9 different kinds, or however many there are. Which ones do I use? And for me, 95% of the time, I just use system specs and model specs, because I never use view specs, and I very rarely use request specs, for example. The point is, there's just a couple that I use all the time. And so when I come across any feature, I ask myself, do I want to write a system spec right now, or do I want to write a model spec right now? And once you have it narrowed down to that, it's like, oh, okay, now I've decided I want to write a system spec. And then I have kind of like a formula that I follow each time, a paint by numbers kind of approach that I use to write those system specs. And so at that point, like, all the difficult intellectual work is like done. But of course, in order to like get to that place of things being easy, you need to have like kind of a lot of experience recognizing those scenarios and then applying the solution. Getting there isn't easy. Once you're there, it is easy. Is that kind of parallel to what you're talking about?
Let me keep riffing on that. Maybe we'll figure that out. So what that reminded me of is, I think like the next level, like the eighth Don black belt sort of like application of this is, like, you just described like two. So you have a set of solutions, right? And then you have let's say an enumerated like set of problems. So like basically, okay, my problem can be of a view, a request, a system, or whatever. Like, it fits in one of these 8 categories. And then like I have my solution set over here, which is like I have view specs, request specs, system specs, and model specs, right? And then the what you just described is like matching A to B, okay? When it starts to, but like when you start to like graduate out of that, I think, is like when you're thinking, oh crap, this thing on the problem list has nothing on the solution list, or like there's not an appropriate selection on the solution list, and coming up with the solution that fits that problem is like when you start to realize, like, oh, okay, now I'm really starting to get this, because you start to realize that the solutions on that solution list, like request specs, system specs, or whatever, like those are just abstractions that someone else came up with, right? For like a certain class of problems. So like someone wrote like 1,000 lines of glue code that puts together what a system spec is, right? And I've noticed this in Puma lately, is we've basically started organically to come up with a testing DSL, because Puma, we have to test what it, like we have to start Puma servers, do stuff to them, and then shut them down, right? So like that's like a kind, like that's a thing that we have to do over and over. And that doesn't correspond to like an RSpec request spec or of whatever. Like there's nothing like that, right? It doesn't even make sense like in that paradigm. So like we're coming up with this new DSL, which you could maybe call a Puma spec. I don't know. And like I feel like it's like the next level of pattern recognition, when you can say, this does not fit one of the 8 things that I have in front of me to apply. And similar problem I had with the Rails Performance Workshop, when I realized that I wanted to write tests for the command line client, and there's really like no good way to do that. Like no one had, there was no off the shelf like abstraction for me to create like a test that tested a command line output and like allowed me, it's an interactive command line. So like I use all these libraries to like let you select lessons and stuff. And it's kind of like a fairly complicated like relationship between standard in and standard out. It's like, how, you know, I have to like create a new like level of, I have to create system specs for, you know, my system now, right? And like, that's a whole other level.
Yeah. So just to nerd out on something that's like not relevant at all, are you using like TTY prompt or are you using something else for that? Or how are you doing that?
I'm not using anything. You can take a look at it and tell me what to do.
Oh, interesting.
I think I wrote like one spec that just like starts up the command line and makes sure it puts the right thing into standard out, but it's extremely simple. You can look at it and tell me what to do. I'd love some input because it's actually a kind of complicated command line client. So like, I don't even know where to start.
Yeah. Well, not even on the testing side, but just like, the prompts that
the
user
the
goes
prompts.
Through.
So, the night before I launched it, a friend of mine told me about this, library. I think it's called Cli UI. It's by Stripe. And it's extremely slick. And I've rewrote everything in like 12 hours to use this new library.
Oh,
and
wow.
It looks super good. It's like helps you do colors and glyphs. And like it lets you do these like selections between multiple items. So like, I don't even know how to describe it. But like when you type the lesson list command, like it'll show you every lesson in like a selectable list. So you can navigate through this list with the arrow keys. You can type the name of the lesson and it will like filter down the list. So like it goes to what you typed. It's extremely slick. And if you're writing a command line, anything, by the way, I would highly recommend checking out that library.
Yeah, I'm Googling around right now and looking for it. I'm not immediately finding it because when I Googled Stripe CLI UI, I just found like the actual Stripe CLI, and so I'm not finding like the tool that lets you create your own UI stuff. The thing that I have used is TTY prompt, which I've found to be great, but now I want to compare it with this Stripe tool to see like if the Stripe thing is better, because, you know, famously everything Stripe does is like the best thing ever.
Yeah, it's really slick. It has these like progress bars too. So like it took me like two lines of code and now I have these like really slick progress bars that show up when you download a video through the client. So it's super cool.
Oh, that is cool. Yeah, I did something in one of my classes where I did some testing, which in hindsight was maybe a mistake because it turned out to be like more complicated than I thought it would be. But I didn't want to burden my students with like learning all the Rails testing tools and stuff like that, because they didn't even have web development experience, so that's just like way too much. And so instead I had them write a command line program using TTY prompt, and it was like a restaurant ordering system or something like that. And then I remember what it was. it was this really silly project. There was like this metaphysical psychotherapy clinic or something like that, where you could get like I don't know, some place that would have like healing crystals and stuff like that. Anyway, it was a system to manage this clinic. And I didn't want to have them write tests for a web application, so I just had them write a command line application and write tests for that. And it was kind of a cool experience, and most of the students were in fact capable of handling it. But what we had to do was like, okay, you have to write some tests that test that this command line program behaves the way you want it to, but how do you manipulate the command line program via tests? So basically what I had to do was like stub or mock out the whole interface part, so that what the program would interact with is like a sequence of commands. And the program could accept that sequence of commands either from a real command line or from like a script that I would stuff into it.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah. So the program was kind of.
That's kind of what I was getting towards in my thing, but it was like, well, there's the name for that. There's what you're describing is just a pattern from Martin Fowler's book, which Patterns of Enterprise Architecture. And I just can't remember the name. But like that middle layer there, or maybe it's Kent Beck, I can't remember, but like that sort of like middle layer that, you know, becomes then the way that this program interacts through the command line, but it interacts with the real world. It was tough with this CLI UI library, because like I wanted to also test that. And it was like, well, that when you're working with someone else's code, it's like, well, I can't, you know, that library assumes you're working with a command line, right? Like working with standard in and standard out. So it's like a whole new world, right? That I just wasn't familiar with. But yeah, that's the right way to do it, right? Is like, don't test the things that are hard. Redraw the boundary so that the easy thing is now that you make it this easy thing testable, and then you leave the 10% that you can't test, and you just say, screw it. Like, at least I got the 90%, right, behind this easy boundary.
Yeah. Yeah, because the meat of the thing is really, like, what happens when you give it such and such? Like, I had another case where I created this gem called Migration Builder, where you could like interactively build migrations instead of having to like look up all the migration syntax.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. And in order to write tests for that, I did the exact same thing. I like decoupled the input mechanism from the actual code. And it's like surprisingly difficult just because it's not a simple thing. Like, there's a whole like tree of possibilities. You know, what if the user puts yes for this? Okay, then this scenario happens. If they put no, then this scenario happens. And then there's these sub questions where you can do A, B, or C. Like, those kind of programs are just kind of complicated to test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So something else I wanted to ask you about, Nate, is relative to Puma. And I think I've asked this question on the show of someone before. It might have even been you. And I think I asked Noah Gibbs this question too. But can you just like explain for us what the heck is Puma, and like what are the other like alternatives that are kind of apples to Puma? Like, I've heard it explained before. I've read about it. I still don't get it. So maybe you can help me out.
Sure. Though the apples to apples is unicorn. So, the unicorn web server is the popular comparison in Ruby. As far as like outside of the Ruby language, it's a bit tougher to think of like a comparable ecosystem, because I'm just not super familiar with what other people are doing. Like Gunicorn, which I think is the Python one, would be a similar setup. So what Puma is really just a fancy wrapper around a layer between a rack application and talking to somebody over a socket, over a TCP socket. So it takes a rack application, translates it into HTTP, and communicates that over a socket to clients.
My apologies, so, Nate. What is a rack application?
Yep. So a rack application is a Ruby object that responds to the call method and returns an array with three elements. The first element is the status code, so 200, 404, 500. The second element is a hash of the, it's not actually, I don't think it technically has to be a hash, but this is me trying to do the rack spec off the top of my head, so if I get this not exactly correct, it's a hash with the HTTP headers. So like accept encoding, cookie, all the headers, that's the second element. The third element is the response body. So, you know, your HTML document or whatever you're actually responding with, it has to be in an array that responds, or it has to be a method. I'm sorry, it has to be an object that responds to each. So that's because we like to go through the object and give it a little piece at a time, a streaming response. So like we need that response object to respond to each. So three elements: first one is a status code, second one is the headers, third one is the actual body of the response. So when we say rack application, that's all we're talking about, is literally one Ruby object that has those characteristics.
Okay. So to take that building block of understanding and to put it back into what you were saying before, can you kind of like repeat what you're saying in context of the wrap up application so I can understand that part?
Yeah. So like somebody opens Puma starts up and it listens to a socket, and there's a bunch of different ways to configure that. But in the typical case, right, we open up a socket on port 3000, a TCP socket on port 3000. That's the default. And somebody connects to that socket and starts sending stuff. So Puma's job is to look at that stuff and say, what the heck is this? Is this a valid HTTP request? And if it is, I will parse it. So that's part of Puma's main jobs, is like turning the bits and bytes off of the socket into a valid HTTP request. And then it looks at the rack application and translates it into a hash, a rack environment that application then understands. So our job basically is to turn HTTP real like bits and bytes on the socket into a rack environment, which is then passed to the rack application via call. So when we say dot call, like the big parameter that we're handing it is this rack environment hash thing. So like that's what Puma's job is on the ingress side, is to turn bits and bytes into rack environment. And then the rack application takes that stuff, does whatever it does, because it's an application, and then gives us back the array, the three element array. Then our job is to turn that back into bits and bytes to the client on the way back.
Got it. So, okay. So here's like what I'm kind of taking away from this. It's basically Puma is like a way for me to have the ability as an application developer or framework developer or whatever. I can create an application or an object, and as long as it has this certain API, like it responds to call and it sends back this like array of three elements or whatever, as long as I conform to that API, then Puma can interface with my object and my object can be a web application. Is that kind of the right idea?
That's exactly right. So, and we're not unique in that respect at all. So like, that's just the rack spec. That's the way that it's designed. And you know, what you just described is how Unicorn works. It's how Thin works. It's how Webrick works. All these applications are rack application servers because they do exactly what you just said. They allow you to take it. They define this interface that has these common inputs and outputs that then allow web servers to take those inputs and outputs and translate them to HTTP.
Okay. My other question was, you had mentioned sockets a number of times. Socket is one of those words that, you know, just because I'm a developer, I've heard the word socket a million times, but I've never bothered to like go and really understand like what the heck is a socket really. Is that something you can explain for us?
Not really. So one of the secrets about maintaining Puma is that you don't actually have to know anything. And when I first got started with Puma, I knew absolutely nothing. So like when you hear people say all these words, say all these fancy words, I knew nothing about threads, sockets, HTTP, any fancy concept you associate with Puma, I knew zero about. Like I just knew Evan personally, and he was like, I'm done with maintaining Puma. Do you and Richard want to do it? Richard Schneeman of Heroku. And I was like, sure. And so I've learned a lot of this along the way. So what I can tell you is that one thing that I've learned from Puma is that Unix-like systems, everything is a file descriptor. And file descriptors are, you know, we think of like files as like myfile.txt. And like, yes, that is a file descriptor. But in a Unix system, everything is a file. So a socket is just a special kind of file. It's a special kind of file descriptor, which you can just think of as being like a a virtual interface to like another system. So like, it's just the operating system saying, okay, port 3000 is, that corresponds in the background to this particular communication that we're having with this external system. Like, that's it. It's just like a kind of made up thing that is a file descriptor, which means we can do all sorts of file descriptory. Like, if you look at the design of Ruby, like the IO class, right, is like the parent for all these different types of IO, like standard in, standard out, files in general, right, sockets. All of these classes in Ruby have IO as a parent because all IOs, all file descriptors, work almost exactly the same way. And sockets are just a kind of file descriptor that are external network resources, not necessarily external because you can talk to yourself, right? Like on localhost, but they're usually network resources is the way I would explain it.
Got it. Okay. Okay. Interesting. So let's see. Those were my Puma questions. At this point, we might even have a little bit of time to talk about the topic we originally agreed to talk about on this show. So Nate, I think we were originally going to talk about, but by the way, all this stuff has been great. I think it's, Puma, like what is Puma? That's something I've been really curious about for a long time. Not curious enough to actually look it up myself and research it, but curious enough to ask you. We were going to talk a little bit about like front end client side performance type stuff. And this is something that's, okay. So in my job, performance isn't really something that comes into the picture a ton. There's one thing. So I've said on the show before that I maintain an application that serves a medical clinic. So it's only like at this point, like 40 or 40 some users using it. So relatively small load. One area I have had to give performance attention is like our physician schedule, because that's one where like people are bouncing around from page to page inside the schedule all day, every day. And so if that's like slow, then people really notice. And also our schedule is just like loaded down with all kinds of like auxiliary information about each patient and stuff like that. And so like,
that's it's so funny that you say that.
Yeah.
So I noticed in my work that there's two types of applications. And the first one is your, what everyone thinks of when they think of web performance, it's like your high load Twitter style app where it's like, oh, we're doing 10,000 requests per second. And it's like the servers are melting. And, you know, like most of those applications are defined by how much request load they get. And so like, I have lots of clients that work like that. That's like one type. And that's the type that everyone thinks about. And then there's this second type of application that comes to me. And it's usually a small team. It's 99% of the time B2B. And their performance problems are not defined by load. Usually they're very low load, like 60 requests per minute or lower load. But they still have these performance problems because they get buried by functionality. And the app has to do so much. And there's like a million if statements. And like it's a complicated app to understand. The different customers can have very different experiences because like this person hits like, you know, this combination of if statements and this other customer hits this other combination of if statements. And it's very hard to follow. And it tends to be a very low, like very high latency application because there's so much going on and it's just a hard beast to understand. So like what, like you started describing that app and I knew you were going to say there was going to be this page with a lot of auxiliary information on it. Like that app, I just see that application so many times. So it's very common to have that kind of app come through my wheelhouse because, you have problems too. And it's just a different set of problems to these other people that like it's an e-commerce company where everybody goes through the same 10 page flow of checking the same thing out. But the problem is that it's 10,000 people doing it per second, right? It's a whole different set of problems, but they're both performance problems.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting and useful distinction. I actually explained that exact same thing to my boss some months ago. Like I was making some changes in our AWS account and I went from one EC2 instance to two. And he's like, so that should make the application faster, right? And I'm like, no, probably not. And then I explained to him everything we just talked about, because our application is that ladder type where like there's just a lot of stuff happening, and adding more servers isn't likely to make much of an impact, because all of the stuff that makes it slow is just because like it's a slow feature that has to hit the database a million times and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I said all that for potentially some sort of reason, but I don't remember what that reason was. But I'll mention the other thing that I was going to mention, which is a super long time ago, like in 2007 or 8, I read this book called High Performance Websites by Steve Souders. And he talked about like...
Oh, yeah.
He talked about all these things he did to make to improve the performance at Yahoo, where he worked. And he said that he was like surprised to discover when he started doing profiling, he discovered that like 50% plus of the load time was on the front end. Like rendering the HTML page, that was often like, I think even as little as 10%. And then all the like loading images, CSS, etc., that was all on the front end. So to what extent, Nate, have you had to like do that front end performance optimization?
Oh, I mean, it's probably a quarter of my work. So the CGRP, it's one out of the four, my book, it's one out of the four main sections of the book. And in the new workshop, it's one out of the six sections of the workshop. And it's just, it's people are surprised by that, I think, because like I'm branded as like the Rails performance guy, but Rails has always had a sort of full stack tradition, even if nowadays like a lot more people are using it as like a backend for a React app or whatever. But still, I find the same people are writing the React as write the Rails code, right? Or at least there's a little bit of overlap there. And so you can't divorce the backend response time from what happens in the browser afterward. So I think there's like a little bit of a like tendency to get overly focused on backend response times as a backend developer, because they're the things that I think it's just the way we think. We're like, we think of the thing that we work on all day is the most important part of the experience. And it's just not borne out by the data. Like, it's just like you said, 25%, I would say, on average of the response time or the load time of a web page's backend can be much less than that for sure. And there's so much else that happens in the browser that people need to understand to what makes browser performance difficult, I would say, is that it's asynchronous and parallel. So when you're looking at the backend response of a Rails application, it's like run this line, then run this line, then run this line. There's not multiple things happening at the same instant in time. But in a browser, there's the CSS, the JS, and all this other stuff, these things are all downloading at the same time. There is a main thread, but it's doing multiple things asynchronously. And understanding how that impacts like how long it takes to get to the load event or how long it takes to get to, you know, whatever the thing is that when you say the page is loaded, that's kind of hard, like especially for a backend developer that's not used to thinking in that kind of world. So part of why I like doing my material on that a lot is because I speak to it from a backend developer perspective. Like, I'm not throwing all these JavaScript browser fancy terms at you that you've never heard of before. It's tough. And Steve's stuff is great, by the way. Steve had this website, which I'm not sure is still online, where Steve had, it was like a bunch of different scenarios where like, it was like a fake web page that would like, you could say, okay, this web page has a script that loads in 5 seconds, and it has an image that loads in 10 seconds, and it has a CSS file that loads in 3 seconds. And then you could hit refresh and it would actually give you that page, and you could see like how it loaded. So like, there's like that old performance advice about don't put JavaScript before CSS. So like, you could actually try that and see what the impact was. Mm-hmm. That page, I think, is not online anymore, or it doesn't work anymore or something, you know, I don't remember, but I reproduced this exercise for the Rails performance workshop. So in the workshop, you get a local version of that exercise where we give you like this fake web application that has a JavaScript file that renders in that takes 5 seconds to respond, and you know, a CSS that takes 3 seconds to respond. Okay. Then now that we know that, like, what does the page look like? How does it render? And like, you can mess with that and like see how that changes page load times. So Steve's stuff was very formative to my work.
Yeah, I'll try to dig something up of his for the show notes, because I thought that book was great when I read it. And I'm sure like not all of it is super relevant now, but like I read that book, and then, you know, Rails 2 did not have the asset pipeline. Am I remembering that correctly? That was a new thing for Rails 3?
No, it was, I don't think the asset pipeline was till 3.1.
Okay. Yeah, so I read that book, and then I saw the asset pipeline come along, and I was like, oh, I know what this is about, because like this is applying the practices that are in that book. And so Nate, when you people are working on Rails applications, how much do they really have to be cognizant of those front-end performance concerns? Because like a lot of that stuff is kind of taken care of by Webpack, or not Webpack, the asset pipeline, and so like those best practices are kind of already implemented.
Well, I think two things. One is that any performance solution starts with monitoring. So if you're not monitoring front-end performance, if you don't have metrics, then you have no idea. And it's the name of these solutions nowadays is real user monitoring. So that's often abbreviated as RUM. New Relic has a RUM solution. Datadog has a RUM solution. Lots of companies have this now. You should be turning that on. So from a privacy perspective, it's kind of tough, because it's like it's information being sent from a browser back to you, back to a third party. So, you know, check out your GDPR requirements or whatever on that. You know, all these companies want to make it as easy as possible to adopt them, so they have plenty of tutorials on this, but you got to check that stuff first. There's basically a standard series of APIs now in the browser called the Web Performance API. And it just provides information like when the page loaded, how long it took to download. And like nowadays, you can even get individual resources and say, like, how long did this image take to download? And it just reports that information back to a third party. And if you don't have that information, then you don't know. You don't know if you should care about it or not, right? Like, if it's reporting back 2 seconds on every page load, then like you're fine. Like, don't think about front end performance. It's fine. Whatever you're doing is fine. But if it's reporting back 5, 6, 7, 8 seconds, then yeah, you have a problem, and you gotta learn this stuff. So that's the first thing. It always starts with monitoring. Second thing, don't use client side A/B testing. if I can give one front end performance tip that seems to solve 30% of people's issues, it's using these client-side A/B test frameworks. So Optimizely, Google Optimize is the new one that everyone seems to use. They're awful. Basically, it's just a thing that delays your page load by a second or more, guaranteed. And it's fine, I guess, if you're actually running A/B tests, but 90% of the places I walk into that have these things, I'm like, this thing is slowing down your page load by a second and a half. Are you actually even running any A/B tests? And they always say no. So don't use client-side A/B testing. Use server-side A/B testing. There's plenty of frameworks in Rails to do that for you. The reason why this is a problem is because think about how a client-side A/B test has to work, right? We download HTML document, right? And it says, it has like, let's say it's a store, and it has like our store layout. Then we've got a JS tag from Optimizely or whatever. That page will not render. It won't show anything until we go to usually there's some sort of snippet you put in that causes this behavior. It won't render the page until we go to Optimizely, download the Optimizely script, which is usually quite large, and then run it. That's another step to compile and run it. And then actually let Optimizely run the test and like change the output of the page, like change the headline or whatever, right? So that page is blank from the period of time when you started downloading the Optimizely script to when it finishes running and changes the headline, right? That is all new extraneous stuff that you've added, right? If you got rid of that Optimizely script, then that page would be ready to go, but it's not because it has to run all this client-side A/B testing code. Now, the server-side A/B testing avoids this because you just send the document to the customer or the client with the A/B test already applied, right? So there's no additional downloading or JavaScript or whatever that has to run. So it's just done. It's ready to go. There's no additional performance loss there. But yeah, this client-side A/B test stuff, it was like the way that A/B testing caught on in 2012, I want to say, because it's super easy to install. And it allows the like marketing people to like write these A/B tests, right? Which makes them very popular. But every single place I've walked into that uses this, it's like a second penalty to every page load. And that nowadays, we have a lot of data on this stuff about how, you know, what is the relationship between page load time and revenue or conversion rates. And my rule of thumb is that a second delay in page load is about a 5 to 10% reduction in any relevant business metric. So let's call it sales revenue. You know, these A/B tests, in my opinion, are the client side A/B tests are automatic. You're already losing 5 to 10% of your conversion rate in order to test possibly a 1 to 2% improvement in your conversion rate. So it's just not worth it.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, it's hard to imagine how anybody could find that cost justifiable based on how crazy of a cost it adds to the page load time. Yeah, okay. So that is a good tip. If you're using one of those client-side tools for A/B testing, don't do that.
Google Optimize is the big one I've been running into in the last year. So it's this like, they call it the Google Optimize anti-flicker snippet. And I notice it always because I have ad block turned on and it actually blocks the A/B testing script. But it doesn't block the event handler being installed. So on these Google Optimize pages, I just get this second and a half white, like, you know, the page is just white until this Google Optimize timer times out. I've encountered a number of clients this year.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, Nate, this has been great. I would even say this is my favorite podcast I've recorded today. So this has been wonderful. we talked about what's Puma. We talked about front-end performance. And then in the beginning, we kind of talked about your workshop, which I highly encourage people to go check out. I bought your book, Nate. I bought it some time ago, and it's great. And like everybody I know who says things about it says great things about it. So dear listener, I encourage you to go check that out too. Also, Peter Cooper, if you're listening, feel free to put us in Ruby Weekly again like you did last time. That was great. It gave us a bunch of downloads. Anyway, Nate, before we wrap up here, where should people go if they want to find out more about you and the performance work that you do?
Speedshop.co.
All right. And that's kind of the hub where people can go and find everything else?
Yep, that's the hub. Or follow me on Twitter, Nate Berkebeck on Twitter.
All right, Nate, thanks so much for coming on the show.
All right, thanks a lot, Jason.